You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Okay, well, let me start this by saying we've got John Perkins, best-selling author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and you've written a whole bunch of other stuff, but I just finished Hoodwinked, An Economic Hitman Reveals Why the Global Economy Imploded and How to Fix It. It was pretty fascinating, and for somebody who's grown up all over the world, and I like the way you break the book up, but I grew up all over the world. My father was a banker and dealt with, you know, lending these countries money and all that stuff. And so he has a very different point of view, by the way. your point of view is rather controversial, because there are a lot of people that when they hear that, in fact, we saddled these countries with debt on purpose and the CIA kind of backs us up, a lot of people lose their minds. I've talked to a lot of people who actually worked overseas for many years. And one of the things they bring up, John, is the fact that, you know, a lot of these companies went bankrupt or at least lost big in lending these countries money. I'm sure you've heard all these things. And then, of course, the fact that, you know, a lot of countries that did have multinational investment ended up having a higher standard of living than those countries that were more protectionist.
That depends on what you mean by higher standard of living, actually. Hmm. You know, you could say that Indonesia has a higher standard of living today than it did in the 70s when I was there. And yet if you walk through the, you know, through the slums of Jakarta or any major city in Indonesia, you'll see something quite different. Mm. So things have certainly changed, and our measurements are very, very inaccurate as to standard of living. You know, income per capita is not a measure of much at all, except how well the wealthy are doing. And as far as the banks going bankrupt are concerned, as far as I know, the World Bank has never gone bankrupt, nor the Asian Development Bank, nor the IMF, nor the Inter-American Development Bank. And the banks in this country that got into trouble were bailed out by us, the taxpayers, and repackaged everything that they had lost money on and resold it once again. I think they all did pretty well.
As you're speaking, I'm reminded of, I sat next to a guy who was, I guess, one of the managing directors of the Latin American Bank. And what he said to me on the plane is, he said, you know, we've done our job. As far as Latin America, you know, they've got banks and things are, their economy is doing better than it has been. But there's no reason really necessarily to have a Latin American Development Bank. Yet we have, I think it was something like 16,000 employees or something crazy. And everybody needs a job in Washington. Everybody's got to justify their job. And you're not going to make that government agency go away. Right.
And let's face it, it provides a lot of work and profits for big corporations. And of course, you know, the Bolivarian countries, as they're called, Venezuela, to a certain degree Colombia, but Venezuela, Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia are creating their own Banco del Sur to offset the Inter-American Development Bank.
Mm. And talk a little bit, John, about what got you to write this. Anybody who spends this much time writing a book, you know, there's a lot of passion in it. And there's a lot of, I always appreciate somebody who really stops and says, there's an injustice in the world and I'm going to write about it. Can you just bring us through kind of what was the seminal moment when you said, I can't do this anymore, I got to write a book about it?
I was an economic hitman for 10 years. Actually, my title was chief economist at a major consulting firm. I had a pretty large staff, about three or four dozen employees working for me. And during that 10 years, from the very beginning, I started to see that things weren't what we were told. So I'd been taught in business school exactly the line that the World Bank sells us, and that is that the way to help developing countries get out of poverty is to make huge loans to them to build infrastructure projects, and that'll bring the poor up out of poverty. And from the very beginning, my first trip to Indonesia, I began to see that that wasn't exactly the case. That these big investments did increase gross domestic product. They showed economic growth, but what was really happening was that the statistics are based on the recorded economics in the country, and that is heavily skewed toward very rich people. So the poor people can be getting poorer and poorer, while a handful of rich families are getting richer and richer, and the overall economic statistics are rising. And you can show that when you invest in big power plant projects with transmission lines and distribution systems, those who own the industries, who own the commercial establishments, make a lot of money, and that increases the economic growth. And certainly we see the same thing in this country, where you can be showing increased economic growth while more people are becoming unemployed, and housing foreclosures are increasing. We saw that the last few years. And all that's really saying is that these handful of very wealthy people, the 85 people who have more assets than half the world's population, are doing very well at these times. So I began to see this. But at first I didn't quite believe it. You know, I'd been to business school, the World Bank. I believe these people. These are, you know, Robert McNamara, in charge of the World Bank, was a pretty convincing guy. But over time, more and more, I saw that what we were telling people was just a con job. And then it became a little difficult for me to get out. I was living a very interesting life, traveling around the world. I came from a pretty poor teacher's family in New Hampshire, and this was a tremendous opportunity. So I was in denial, and I think that happens to a lot of people. But then after about 10 years, I was on vacation in the Virgin Islands on a sailboat that I'd rented. And one evening I rowed ashore and I climbed up to the ruins of this old sugarcane plantation in the Virgin Islands, St. John. And it was very idyllic up there. These ruins were covered with bougainvillea. It was beautiful. The sun was setting over the Caribbean. I'm sitting there with a can of beer in my hands. It's just ecstatic.
You know? I was going to say, I feel like I should be wearing a white robe right now.
Exactly.
Come on. Where's the lady? Where are the girls?
Well, the girl was back on my sailboat. She was there, too.
The girl was back on my sailboat.
Good man. He's got to go contemplate what his book is going to be.
Well, she was taking a nap, you know. We'd had a pretty ecstatic experience earlier in the afternoon. And
good man, John.
So I'm up there, it's, and I'm looking down on my sailboat where there's this beautiful woman who actually happened to be one of my employees.
I'm liking you even more.
You know, in those days it was more acceptable than it is today. Anyway, suddenly it occurred to me that this sugarcane plantation was built on the bones of thousands of slaves. And the more I thought about this, the more I realized that the whole hemisphere is built on the bones of millions of slaves, including our own indigenous people. And then I had to admit that I was a slaver, a modern-day form of slavery, debt slavery, which is different from shackled slavery, there's no doubt. It's not the same as going into the Africa and dragging people up in shackles, but it's still slavery. And I looked out at my sailboat and I think about the life I'm leading, which is really pretty degenerate. And you know, honestly, you know, I was living off alcohol and Valium and psychotherapy. I was not a happy person. Truthfully, I had all the trappings of what we consider the good life, but I was not happy.
Sure.
And so at that moment, I made the decision I would quit. And I went back to my headquarters in Boston a few days later and quit. And then I started to write the book. And this is early 80s. I contacted other economic hitmen and jackals, their former ones, to get their stories. And almost immediately, I received threatening telephone calls, people threatening my life, and a few years later, I did get married to someone and had a daughter, and they threatened her life. By the time I was writing this book, this was 1982, 83. And then chairman of the board at Stone & Webster, a major consulting firm in Boston and New York, took me out to dinner one night, and he said, "Hey, you know, you got a great resume." I did. I'd been chief economist of one of his rival companies. He said, "We'd like to use your resume in proposals. You won't have to do any work for us. Just let us use your resume, and I want to pay you a $500,000 retainer. Just don't write the book that you're working on." And I have to say, you know, my life's being threatened. My daughter's life's being threatened. I'm being offered a bribe. It's a totally legal bribe. It's what he did. And I took the money. In my own defense, I'll say that I did not go out and buy a fast car or a big house. I invested the money in sort of a new career. I went down back to Latin America, to the Amazon, to people I'd been a Peace Corps volunteer with and offered to help them save their rainforest. I formed a nonprofit called Dream Change, which still exists. You can go to dreamchange.org. And out of that grew Pachamama. You can go to pachamama.org, Pachamama Alliance. And I wrote 5 books on indigenous people, which was fine with Stone & Webster.
One of which, by the way, the Dalai Lama read and had in his hand, I think, when you were on the same plane as he was.
Yes, yeah,
shapeshifting. Yeah.
Because he walked through the airport in Leh Ladakh carrying my book, Shapeshifting.
That's pretty cool, by the way. That was
very cool. And he invited me to sit next to him. We had a great flight, and then went to his house afterwards with a group of people that I was leading around. It was very cool.
I'll take that over the girl on the sailboat, believe it or not. And that's saying a lot. That's saying a lot from a fellow degenerate.
But Brian, what if you could have both?
Then I'd be John Perkins.
Yeah, exactly.
Obviously, I'm not. So yeah. So anyway,
so I didn't write the book, and I wrote other books. And then on 9/11, I was in the Amazon. I'd taken a group of people in to study with, to learn from indigenous people there about preserving the earth, about protecting the rainforest, and so forth. On 9/11, when that happened, but when I came home several days later, I flew up to Ground Zero, and as I stood there looking at that still smoldering pit, I knew I had to write this book. I knew I had to expose what I'd experienced in life. And this time I decided I wouldn't tell a soul I was writing it. I would not write a proposal, look for an advance or anything. I'd write the whole book, get it in the hands of a very, very good New York agent. And at that point, once that happened, it became my insurance policy. Once that agent starts sending it out to publishing houses, it's my insurance policy, and it still is today. You know, it's any good jackal knows that if something strange happens to me, the book's going to sell many, many millions more copies than the millions it's already sold, and that's the last thing they want. They don't want me to be a martyr. They don't want to sell more books.
Well, explain to us, and when you say they, I think you're talking about the CIA and stuff, but explain to us what an economic hitman is, please.
I think it's fair to say that economic hitmen have been the driving force behind forming the world's first truly global empire, and the first empire that hasn't been formed primarily through the military. Primarily, it's been formed through economics and debt. And it's really not an American empire, it's a corporate empire. The way that we work, well, we work many ways, but perhaps the most common is that we'll identify a country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil, and then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations. However, the money never goes to the country. The country never sees a penny of that money. The money goes directly to our own corporations to build big infrastructure projects in that country, things like electrical power systems, highways, and industrial parks that will benefit a few very wealthy families but won't help the majority of the people. Okay, of course, the main beneficiaries are the big corporations. Next are a few wealthy families in the country, the families that own the industries, that use the electricity and the highways and own the industrial parks. But the majority of the people don't benefit because they can't afford electricity, they don't have cars to drive on the highways, they can't get jobs in industrial parks because they don't hire many people, and yet they're left holding a huge debt. And as the country tries to pay down the interest on that debt, it has to divert money from education, health care, and other social services. So the people really suffer from this debt. And in the end, they can't repay the debt anyway. So we go back in, usually in the guise of the IMF, and say, hey, you know, let's restructure your debt. But to do that, you're going to have to sell your resource, oil, whatever, real cheap to our corporations without any environmental regulations or social restrictions, or sell off all of your public sector businesses, privatize your utility companies, your water and sewage companies, your schools, your jails, sell them or almost give them to our corporations, and let us build a military base on your soil. Things like this.
But let me just stop you for a sec, because this is a very, when I was reading it, it sounded terribly cynical in terms of, if you look at, for example, South Korea, and Singapore, even Indonesia, which life expectancy is, I think, shot up by 19 years, there are a lot of good things that have happened, especially South Korea, and who had tremendous multinational investment, Singapore. And there are a lot of countries I think you could point to, including a lot of countries actually in like Brazil and things in South America, that have started to do very well. And so, and I'm talking about on a per capita basis. So then if you look at these corporations you're talking about, the first thing is that they're always competing against each other in these countries. And it seems to me that a lot of those these corporations like General Electric and General Motors and things, they've had some serious issues on their own, had to fire a lot of people, had to be bailed out by our government. So whatever they decided they were doing seems to me not – it probably wasn't such a good plan with all their economic hitmen, was it? I mean, it doesn't sound to me like – and I think this is kind of what you talk about, this rogue capitalism, if indeed we are to – by that premise, with these CIA, you know, working in cahoots with these corporations, it doesn't sound like it worked that well, did it?
Well, I think you're right, Brian. In the long run, it has not worked well. It's an abject failure. Mm. But if you happen to be the vice president of General Motors or General Electric in Asia or Latin America, what you're really concerned about is the next quarterly income statement or the next year's profits. And from that standpoint, it has worked pretty well for a lot of these companies, in the short term. But that's changing, too. Mm-hmm. And you're hitting a very, very important point, Brian, I think, because what we've created globally is a failed economic system that's not going to benefit anybody ultimately. Mm-hmm. It's a failure. There's no other way to describe it. And to me, one of the most telling statistics is that less than 5% of us live in the United States, and we consume almost 30% of the world's resources, mm-hmm. while roughly half the world is starving or on the verge of starvation. That's a failure. It's not a model. China cannot replicate our model, nor can Africa, nor Latin America, nor India. They're trying to. And every time they make a step in the direction of replicating us, another glacier melts a little more, the oceans rise a little higher, more species go extinct, inflation increases. So what we know statistically, 5% consuming 30% of the world's resources, that doesn't work. You can't continue that.
You know, my buddy was just in Beijing and said he literally couldn't see the buildings in front of him. And the pollution is so bad, it's beyond what you can imagine.
Right. And yet China will, you know, we say China has had an economic miracle, the only country in history that we know of that's had double-digit economic growth for 3 decades. That's just recently changed. But
you have a great chapter about that where in the book I really appreciated it because you kind of said we can learn from China both on what to do and what not to do.
Right. And that's what the premise of Hoodwink, that the book you're referring to, is that we have this failed economy, and we need to move into a new economy. So what we really have is what I call a death economy worldwide. It's an economy that's to a large degree based on militarization. The U.S. budget is heavily leaned towards militarization, 21% of the official budget. But if you look at the spinoffs, it approaches 50%. And beyond militarization, it's based on ravaging and destroying the earth, resources. It's truly a death economy. And what we need to do now, and this is, again, the premise of Hoodwinked, is we need to move into a life economy, an economy that's based on full employment for cleaning up pollution, for helping starving people around the world grow food more efficiently, store it and distribute it.
Well, you're talking about, and you say it in your book, you're talking about moving away from this mutant form of capitalism, predatory capitalism. And I should mention to the listeners, you are not a socialist. You are a believer in free markets and in capitalism, but it's this mutant form of capitalism where essentially corporations rig the system and are not providing, it's not the good old-fashioned, I provide a service you want, you're willing to pay good money for it, and I compete in an open marketplace.
You're right. I am a capitalist, but I'm a capitalist of pre-Milton Friedman capitalism. In other words, I went to business school in the late 60s.
I read Free to Choose. I read all of it. I was indoctrinated on F.A. Hayek and on Milton Friedman. That's the libertarian's Bible, as it were.
Well, yeah. I mean, this idea. So I grew up with I went to school and was taught in business school that a good CEO makes a decent rate of return for his investors. That's the only way you get investors. But you also take good care of your employees. You give them health care and retirement pensions. And a good CEO takes a cut in pay before he lays anybody off. Boy, didn't that change with General Electric and Jack Walsh, you know? It's
sure.
And all the CEOs today. And so the profit motive was only one of many motives. A good CEO takes good care of his customers and his suppliers, and he's a good citizen. A corporation has to be a good citizen in the communities where it works, pays taxes. Imagine that.
Well, but that is changing, isn't it? You talk about that. I mean, I remember I read an article about IBM. IBM is a very responsible company for, when it comes to environment. You can't do business with IBM unless you yourself go through a checklist approved by them that says you are essentially a green company or as close to green as possible. So in a way, as consumers become more educated, and I think you talk about this, companies are overall becoming good citizens, aren't they? Corporations are becoming much better than they were.
Yes, and yes, Brian, and the ones that are going to be successful are going to do that more and more. I just came back from speaking at a conference of 2,000 business executives. I was the keynote speaker, and it happened to be in Istanbul. And a couple of years ago, I spoke to a conference there of 4,000 CEOs and CFOs of corporations. And when I speak to these people, and I do it quite often, it's not just those two examples, but when I speak to these people, I say, you know, we are in a new era, and we have to move into a life economy in order to survive. And you guys, you kids of corporations, need to understand that the successful corporations of the future, the short-term future as well as the long-term future, are the ones that are going to be moving in the direction of creating a life economy, a sustainable world, one that's socially just, that's fulfilling for people on many levels, and where everybody has the opportunity to prosper at some level, not necessarily financially, but live thriving, prosperous lives. That's the future. And the corporations that understand that are going to be the success stories of the near and long-term future.
Do you think it's slightly reductionist to make it out as if it's only the corporations that are the boogeyman? I mean, the whole term corporatocracy is if that's the problem, because government can be just as much of a problem in that as well. I mean, you know, the IMF, the World Bank, you know, the 16,000 employee development banks. I mean, you know, Milton Friedman, I mean, in the interest of disclosure, my dad studied with Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago. And, you know, so my dad, I talked to him about this last night, and he would be the first to admit that he did not get a balanced economic education, you know,
right,
because he learned Friedmanism. He did not learn, and, you know, in the beginning of the book, you talk about the difference between Keynes and Friedman, who are the two big economic thinkers. But, you know, Friedman, much of what Friedman was saying was right. It's not that he's entirely wrong. He was responding to a very specific problem, which is that the government was messing around with the money supply. And the money supply is a public trust. It's something we need, a reliable money supply. And he was dealing with massive inflation. And so much of what he's saying is right. And I think part of the danger is that we get these very unnuanced conversations about economics where it's like the corporations are bad or that free market needs to be regulated. And, you know, it's like we talked
about. It's a balance. It's a mesh, right?
It's a balance.
Right, John? It's a question of coming up with the right balance of What is a free market? Where do free markets work? I mean, remember, the banking industry has been pretty heavily regulated, hasn't it, since probably 1900 or something, I'd imagine.
Yeah, although we dropped a lot of those regulations.
Yes, we did.
And that's where it went wrong.
Yes, we did.
Right.
And because a lot of libertarian thinkers came in and bullied their way through. I mean, there's I think the book that's very good about this is The Big Short. Michael Lewis talks about this. I mean, a lot of these, the Glass-Steagall Act and things were very good, and they were there for a reason and got sort of pushed aside, right?
Yeah. And I want to go on record of saying, you know, I do not believe corporations are bad at all. Corporations are hope for the solutions to these things. Corporations are just people, mm-hmm. and they respond to what we, the people, the consumer, requires, demands of them. And, you know, really, up until now, we've said, geez, you know, I want good quality and cheap tennis shoes, and if they happen to be made by slaves in a sweatshop in Indonesia, I'll just look the other way. Mm. I want cheap gas for my car, and if that means destroying the Amazon rainforest, I'll just look the other way. I mean, we've sent this message, and the corporations have encouraged it because it's helped them maximize profits, which is what Friedman says is the only thing they need to do. But it's time now that we turn this around, and we are. People are turning this around all over the world. In the last year, I've been all over Southeast Asia, parts of Europe and the Middle East and Latin America, North America. And everywhere I go, I find that people really are waking up. But we're getting it, that the 1%, which is really more like 0.0001%, have been screwing us. Mm. And to their economic benefit, in the short term at least, And people are getting it. That's why we're seeing, you know, people taking to the streets in Turkey and Egypt and Russia and China and Venezuela and the United States, the Occupy movement and the Arab Spring. I mean, we're seeing something amazing happening. It's a consciousness revolution.
You sound like you're fairly optimistic about the future, because a lot of Generation Y kids were talking about money being less important and meaning in their lives being more important.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? I mean, Generation Y, Generation Z, they grow up knowing that we're in trouble. You don't have to convince them to be environmentalists. They got it. They grow up with that, and they're saying, you know, well, yeah, I want to have enough money to live a good life, but what's more important is to have more time to be with family, to enjoy myself, to do what I want to do, whether it's art or travel or whatever, and I want a job that's significant. I don't want to just sit behind a desk and grind out numbers to help some big corporation become wealthy and live a miserable life. I want to do something that'll make the world a better place for my kids and my grandchildren. I hear this all the time when I'm speaking at universities, and I didn't hear it 10 years ago. Things have changed a lot.
That's interesting. That's an interesting thing. Yeah, it's interesting how consciousness, how you can get a sort of a general change in thought patterns. It's always encouraging, I'm sure, because you spend a lot of time talking to people that way. I'm, as a comic, it sounds weird, but I'm up in front of all different kinds of people, especially all over the United States and in Canada. And I communicate with them for an hour at a time, and then afterwards I speak to them, and it is pretty interesting. You can really tell, like, sort of what jokes work and what themes work and what resonate with an audience, and it changes. It really does. There is a big difference, I think, between today and 10 years ago. For example, 10 years ago, as a comic, you can make fun of gay people really openly. And, you know, you better be careful with that now, because you've got people, and I think it's a good thing, you've got people in the audience who are gay, who are no longer hiding, who are no longer being shamed. They're just like, look, this is how I am. I'm different than the status quo or the normal people, and it's not okay for you to call me a faggot. It's not okay for you to make fun of me because, by the way, I used to get beaten up, or by the way, those words like faggot, in other words, were used while people were kicking me in the stomach or beating up my friend or killing somebody I knew for being gay. And I think I always find that very encouraging, that there seems to be at least two things going on. One is people are not as afraid to sort of etch out their own space and to speak their mind without feeling like they're going to get crushed by the mob. The other thing is that it feels as though there's an equality of consumption to an extent, even though there are problems with the growing divide between the rich and the poor. You do see a lot of people who don't have a lot of money, at least with a cell phone, at least with a TV, things like that. And that feels like, it feels like technology, as it becomes cheaper, is going to permeate into countries like that never had it before, like sub-Saharan Africa and things like that. And if that is the case, then keeping information and the truth of the situation away from the masses is going to be more and more difficult, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, I think there's a couple of very significant things that have happened recently. One is that around the world, we're waking up to the fact that we're all facing the same crises. Used to be that, you know, people in San Francisco had to worry about earthquakes, and in Florida, hurricanes, and in Indonesia, tsunamis. But today, we know that we are all facing melting glaciers, the big rivers that provide water to India and China are drying up because the glaciers in the Himalayas are receding. And that's going to have a huge impact. We're all realizing that the oceans are rising and species are going extinct.
Are we all realizing that, John? Because I think that at least 50% of America doesn't realize that that's a problem.
Even more. Yeah.
But I think it's the message is getting out there. You know, it wasn't but a few years ago that there was a debate over whether there was really global warming or not, and that debate's practically gone away. I mean,
I don't know, John.
But actually, John, you know what's funny about what you just said is I was in Minnesota performing this past weekend, and I said, I worry about crazy things. And I went, I worry about things I have no control over, like drought. And when I said that, they all started laughing because they were all like, you know what? I worry about drought, too. I just thought to myself that we have a serious drought in California. I don't know what to do about it. And weather patterns are changing. That hurricane in Sandy in New York, I mean, there are parts of Jersey they're saying may never be the same.
Yeah.
You know? But do you really think, I mean, I think that's the big thing. Do you think that really people are waking up to that problem? Because I think, John, really what you're talking about is the difference between short-term and long-term thinking, denialism versus embracing reality. That's the difference between the life and the death economy, as you call it, right? And I think it's too easy to engage, it's too tempting to engage in denialism and say there is no global warming, weather patterns aren't changing, we can engage in the same behaviors.
That's where hoodwinked, and that's where people like John come in and podcasts.
And you. And you guys. I mean, and this is springing up. I'm on shows every day, practically, when I'm at home, sometimes four or five a day, and I travel all over. It's just in Istanbul and CNN, Turkey, and major television stations there talking about these same things. So, and 10 years ago, that wasn't happening. When Confessions first came out, which is almost 10 years ago, I would travel around. I would meet with university students. I wouldn't hear this. Yes, people are waking up, and whether it's 50% of the population or whatever it is, it's a heck of a lot more today than it was 5 years ago, and a lot more than it was 10 years ago. It is happening. Believe me, people are getting it. And you know, what's the critical mass that needs to get it? Nobody really knows what the critical mass is.
But there is one. We know that.
And you know, I think, I mean, you know, the fact that the U.S. Congress has woken up to what the NSA is doing because of what Snowden did is going to have an impact. And, you know, we hope it'll have a bigger impact than it probably will. But we are waking up. I'm absolutely convinced as I travel around, as I said, you know, I met with peasants in Myanmar about a year ago, and with ones in Ecuador a couple of months ago. You can talk to people who are almost illiterate, and they get a sense of what's going on too. Not all of them, of course. Not everybody has woken up so far. But the other fascinating thing that's happened is that for the first time in human history, we all have the capability of communicating with each other instantaneously.
Right.
You know, a few years ago, I was high up in the Himalayas in Tibet, 17,000 feet, talking to a tribal chieftain up there, a nomad, who was complaining that his people would never have telephones because the lines would never reach that far. He has a telephone today, a satellite cell phone.
Amazing.
They do deep in the Amazon. And, you know, all the information practically that's ever been printed is available to every one of us almost instantaneously on our phones.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid growing up in New Hampshire and I went to college in Vermont, I decided what term papers I would write based on what information there was in the little library there. That's totally obsolete. So, and I really think that a tremendous number of us are understanding that we live on a very fragile space station. And unlike the one that our astronauts built, this one doesn't have any shuttles. We can't get off. My 6-year-old grandson won't be able to get off, or if he can, if it's conceivable that he can go to the moon when he's my age, not many people will, and that will not be the solution. The solution is to take care of this space station that we're living on. And I really think a tremendous number of us are getting it, and every year more and more of us get it.
Well, your book, you know, what I also appreciate is you, that second half of the book is this is the current economic crisis is not a fluke, but here's what we do to fix capitalism, fix the capitalist system. You don't want to overthrow it. We're not Mao Zedong here, but this is how you fix it. And it starts, like you said, with consumers educating themselves and making the prudent decisions, the decisions that affect not just themselves, but the community and the world at large, right?
It's understanding that the marketplace is a democracy. And whenever we buy something, it's a vote. Or when we choose not to buy something, that's a vote.
I like the way you put that. Whenever you buy something, it's a vote.
Yeah.
That's right.
But you also have to send an email to the corporation. So, you know, if I want to buy a pair of tennis shoes and I love the Nike shoes, but I won't buy them, I need to send an email to Mark Parker, the CEO, and say, or to just a Nike, and say, hey, you know, I love your tennis shoes, but as long as you get slaves working for you in sweatshops in Indonesia, I'm not buying them. Pay those people a living wage, and I'll buy your shoes. It's what we buy and how we shop, but it's also letting those people know and letting the ones know who we do buy from that we appreciate the fact that they're trying to do a better job.
And you even say that sometimes things can be too expensive, like your daughter's crib if she was going to buy something from Canada where the wood was sustained from not old growth forests, etc., it was going to cost $600 as opposed to the one that was $200. That's too expensive for some people, but at least be aware of the ripple effect that whatever it is you're buying has.
Well, I like the way my daughter stated that. She said, you know, I am going to, and she worked for a nonprofit. She was not making much money. She said, I'll buy the more expensive crib because it's an investment in my son's future. And I would pay, I'll pay to buy a good car seat to save his, to protect his life. And I need to recognize that, that this crib is creating a better world for him if I'm buying it from a company that doesn't use slave labor and has wood that's been, you know, sustainably grown. And if you can't afford that, to recognize there's a foregone cost of investment, and that when you can afford it, you will, to just have that awareness that we need to create a better world. And in fact, if enough people buy that crib, the price will come down, and the price of the other one will go up. To really understand this, you know, we've used this the marketplace as a democracy very successfully in the past. We got rid of apartheid in South Africa because we because we boycotted companies that supported it. And we got companies to clean, like General Electric, in fact, to clean up terribly polluted rivers in this country because we forced them to, and to open their doors wider to women and minorities, to label foods for what's, you know, what, how many calories they have and how much nutrition, et cetera. We've had tremendous success when we focused on specific issues, and now it's time to focus on the big issue and to say that the job of corporations is not to maximize profit. It's to make a decent rate of return so they can get investors, so we can move into new areas that will create a life economy. But the main job of corporations is to serve a public interest, to serve us, the people.
Boy,
the
I'll tell you what, I can just see a lot of people working in corporations going, who is this young kid? Who's this young, idealistic, socialist leaning kid, John Perkins? You know what I mean? What is this guy? Just out of college, for God's sake? You know, I really appreciate your passion and idealism and your outrage, because that tends to temper. And that tends to kind of give way to practicality and people going, listen, okay, but, you know, we all got bills to pay.
Hey, those people that are asking those questions ought to realize that I was born at the end of World War II, and and I've been a major corporate executive on several different levels, and a very successful entrepreneur. And I count among some of my best friends very powerful corporate executives, and I speak at conferences to thousands of CEOs and CFOs. I'm not naive.
No, I know.
And I think what we're talking about here is true reality. The reality is we have created a failed system. And it was successful for a long time. It brought great things. You know, we've landed men on the moon. We've eradicated a lot of ancient illnesses. We've done incredible things with medicine. We've done incredible things with the arts. We have amazing opera and music of all sorts. We've done amazing things. And we've gone a little too far. We've reached a tipping point where all of those things that we've invented are now coming back to haunt us. And what we need to realize is that we can use all that we've learned about this earth and about technology in a new way, and that is to stop creating a death economy, to stop ravaging the earth, and instead to create an economy that's based on taking care of the earth and ourselves. And that can be an incredibly successful economy, and we can feel very blessed in doing it. It brings a new joy to us. What an amazing time we live in, you know? Mm-hmm. And people will say, hey, you're advocating growth. We got to stop growth. And I say, well, you walk the streets of Calcutta and tell me we got to stop growth. The starving people there, they need food. They need clothing. They need shelter.
Yeah, same and health care and all that stuff.
Yeah, same is true in Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's right.
or New York. We need growth. We need growth in businesses that will clean up terrible pollution across this planet. And new technology, things nobody's even conceived of before. Why are all those people in L.A., you know, who weigh, you know, 120 to 300 pounds driving around in one-ton vehicles, or, you know, it's absurd.
Yeah.
So there's a tremendous opportunity here to create a full employment economy that is serving us and in serving the earth.
Mm.
Well, a lot of what you're talking about is, you know, people using their voting with their purchases. But the other thing here is, what about regulation? What about government regulation? Because that's been utterly messed up. And, you know, Lawrence Lessig has spoken very persuasively that issue number one is campaign finance, because until we fix campaign finance, we're not going to get the right incentive schemes for corporations and citizens to be able to respond to.
Right. Right. And, you know, I love what Larry Lessig has to say. I had dinner with him not long ago and have met with him. And he,
tell him to come on the podcast.
Yeah, tell him to come on the podcast.
I'll do that. And, you know, so what was your question?
Well, the point is that absolutely there's what we can do as citizens in the economic sphere in terms of, you know, buying the right things. But also as citizens, as voters, I mean, I think we really need to focus our politicians on saying that campaign finance needs to be fixed, and it needs to be fixed now.
Yeah. Right. And that's a huge campaign that also the Pachamama Alliance, that I'm a co-founder of, you can go to Pachamama.org, we're involved in. We're working with Larry Lessig on that and with Movement to Amend. We need that, definitely. And politics is important. It's anybody who wants to get involved in politics should, and dig in and go after a sustainable, you know, a life economy. But I also think we need to recognize that most politicians are essentially owned by big corporations, and the corporations are the ones that need to exercise power over these. So we need to pressure our corporations to exercise power over the elected officials whose campaigns they finance. I mean, let's face it, we all know that Obama had to end up hiring lots of Goldman Sachs and other Wall Street people to run his financial policy and agribusiness people to run his agricultural policy, because those corporations financed his campaign. And if they hadn't, he wouldn't have been president. Mm. And that's true throughout with all politicians. So, you know, yes, let's go in there and dig out the politics, but let's also understand that one of the great leverage points we have over politicians is through the corporations.
I see. So in other words, voting with your pocketbook, you can either strengthen or weaken a corporation, because you're not getting elected to office unless you've got corporate money. And so that makes a lot of sense. If you want to influence Washington, then you still can do so with your pocketbook.
But here's an example. Florida Power and Light, one of the nation's largest utility companies, was mandated a number of years ago to, required actually by the Public Service Commission in Florida to build a huge coal plant. They had been the number one non-air polluting utility in the nation, and they had no coal plants. When they went out to locate this plant, no community in the state of Florida, which is a fairly conservative state, especially central Florida, no community that they went to would allow them to build a plant on their land. And so in the end, FPNL did not build a coal plant. Instead, they made huge investments in solar and wind. And today, one of their subsidiaries, NextEra Energy, is one of the largest developers in the country, perhaps the world, of solar and wind power. And what's significant about this, I think, is that the CEO of FPNL, back when they were trying to build this coal plant, would go to Washington and lobby against any restraints on carbon dioxide emissions, any controls over that. Now he goes to Washington pretty frequently and lobbies for controls over CO2 emissions, because the Georgia Power, his neighbor in the north, is stealing customers from him because they have very cheap electricity because they have all these terribly polluting coal plants. And he's saying that isn't fair. Should be an even playing field.
Sure.
So the people of Florida spoke. They said no coal plant. And that totally changed the policy of a major utility company that now has totally reversed itself, and rather than fighting pollution controls, is advocating pollution control.
But what about things like the financial industry? Because, you know, I'm not a major user of Goldman Sachs' services. And so, you know, how is it? I mean, if we want Glass-Steagall reinstated or something like that, how is it that we can have an effect on that without simply removing money from politics or severely limiting money from politics so that corporations don't even have the option of buying politicians?
Well, we definitely should eliminate money from politics. I totally agree with that. And I'm a big supporter of Movement to Amend, and so, as I mentioned, the Pachamama Alliance, I co-founded. So we need to do that. And all I'm really saying, though, is that in order to do that, we're probably going to have to get some big corporations behind that movement.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely. What are the corporations that you like, John, that are examples of good stewardship?
Well, you know, I kind of, that's a trap, because I don't mean it that way. Yeah. I hate to mention it, because it's changing all the time.
Right.
And if I mention a company like Whole Foods, which I think has done an amazing job at bringing organic food to our table, I'll get a lot of emails saying, "Yeah, but they don't allow unions in their shop, and now they're allowing GMOs and so on and so forth." All of which is true. So what I would say is that I don't think any companies that are perfect. Who is?
Right.
But there are a lot of companies that are trying to move in that direction, and we really need to encourage them. I mean, we're seeing Walmart move in a greener direction. There's no question about it, and I think that's wonderful. And then people say, yeah, but that's just a public relations ploy. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But the fact is, even if it's a public relations ploy, once you see that as beneficial to you, it catches on more and more, and you move more and more in that direction. So I think what's fair to say is that the companies that are going to succeed, that are going to exist a year, 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now, are the ones that are going to be moving more and more and more in the green direction. And I think most of them are getting it. And the ones that don't move in that direction are going to go out of existence. I recently had breakfast with a group of major investment fund directors. And one of them raised their hand and said, "I don't think Monsanto is going to be around 10 years from now. I will not invest in Monsanto." And a couple of others chimed in and said, "We agree with you. Unless they totally change their policy, they're going to become dinosaurs."
I worry about that a little bit too, though, because Monsanto, I do think that we need GMOs. Ultimately, we're not going to be able to feed all the people on the planet organically. And in fact, GMOs, if done right, can be way greener than organic farming by far. So science in food is not a bad thing, provided it's done the right way. Can you talk a little bit about that and why Monsanto has been vilified and all that stuff? What is it about Monsanto? I haven't followed it enough, but
well, you know, it's a lot of things.
Yeah.
Monsanto's relationship with developing countries has been terrible in terms of getting farmers hooked on using Monsanto insecticides and fertilizers. And ultimately really destroying their lands, or at least getting their lands to a point where they have to constantly go back and put more and more chemicals, and that's very expensive for them, very difficult, and very polluting. They polluted a lot of rivers, a lot of lakes, the ocean. And in our own country, we've seen how Monsanto has sued farmers who you know, I mean, there's one farmer who goes around on the speaking circuit who, you know, seeds blew onto his property that apparently were Monsanto seeds that he didn't plant. And Monsanto found some of these, I think it was corn, that was theirs, and they sued him, you know, and said he could no longer collect seeds. He had to always buy seeds. So one of the things is that when you use Monsanto products, at least some of the products, you can't collect your own seeds and regrow your food. You've got to keep buying seeds from them. Hmm. So there's been this terrible exploitation. And yeah, I think big agribusiness can play a huge role in making a better world, helping starving people feed themselves. But it has to be done with integrity. It has to be done with the idea that this is our goal. Our goal is not to maximize profits and make a few rich people a lot richer. Our goal is to make a better world. And if Monsanto gets that message and does that, then they will be around 10 years from now.
I'm sure they are. I'm sure they are getting it. I think it's impossible not to, isn't it, in this age, as you say. Information is so instantaneous, and as people get the truth of what's really going on, it's really hard to hide.
Well, that's what I was saying earlier, and that's when we get into a little bit of a discussion as how many people really are getting it. But I think it's very possible that the CEO of Monsanto today doesn't get it, but mm-hmm. the next one probably will.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the great things is that the young people coming out of business school and law school, they are getting it, and they're going to be running these organizations in the future. I think a beautiful story, if I may,
please,
is one that recently, well, you mentioned Beijing. I was in China a few years ago, giving a speech at a big conference for MBA students, Chinese MBA students. Now, to be a Chinese MBA student, you have to have been out in the workaday world for several years before you can go in, and most of them are members of the Communist Party. So they are hand-selected And that sounds a little contradictory, doesn't it? Communist Party getting MBAs.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But, welcome to China.
Yeah. These guys, these men and women, are selected to be the future leaders of China. And I gave this speech, and then I taught a couple of classes, and then I hung out with a lot of these young people for quite a while. I stayed for a while just doing that. And what I kept hearing from them over and over was, we in China have proven we can create a miracle. We've created an economic miracle. 3 decades of double-digit economic growth. Nobody else has ever done that. And it's come at a very big price, a horrible price environmentally and socially. But now we've proven we can create a miracle. So we, this new generation, we are going to create a green miracle. China is going to be the greenest country on the planet when we take over. That was incredibly encouraging, you know.
Wow.
I mean, and they meant it. Whether they'll do it or not remains to be seen. But I know they were serious when they were and I heard it from a lot of them.
Well, do you talk about, I mean, harmony in that society? You know, they did a really interesting experiment where they had Chinese people look at a fish tank and Americans look at a fish tank. And the Americans described the fish when asked to describe the fish tank. And the Chinese actually described the fish in some cases last. They were describing the coral and the vegetation and the relationship between all the things in the tank, and how and where the tank actually sat in the room. And so there's a very different mindset. There is this the Confucian idea of harmony and how it fits in. How do we fit in? How do we as a leaf blow on this great tree? And there is that idea. Americans have, which is great, but there is the motif of rugged individualism, and I'm going to pick myself up by the bootstraps and change the world as an individual. You need both.
Right. And that's a very telling description of the fish tank. I love that.
Yeah.
Well, although I would say that the Three River Gorges project, which is them focusing on environmentalism at the expense of evicting, you know, countless people from their homes and destroying one of nature's great wonders.
The government if you're in the way, you're a leaf on a big tree.
That's what we're talking about is that, you know, there are, I mean, listen, yeah, Milton Friedman was trying to solve a problem, and in the process, he created other problems. And, you know, we have the same thing with our agricultural system. You know, Earl Butz in the 1970s was a child of the Depression and so wanted to make sure that we had as much food as possible. Well, congratulations, Earl Butz. We solved that problem and we probably won't have to worry about the Great Depression. But now we have problems with obesity and diabetes and all of these other sorts of things because our food supply is so narrowly focused on corn. So I think what this all really adds up to is taking a long-term view and taking a holistic view that incorporates everything so that we're really thinking about what are the externalities, what are the potential problems that come out of any given choice.
And you know, John, as you were speaking, I was thinking about Thoreau's Walden Pond. The Walden Pond, is that anyway, one of the biggest impacts on my life, that book, just where he says, as a human being, at the end of the day, I just need to regulate my body temperature. I just need to keep my body temperature where it needs to be for me to feel comfortable. That requires some shelter, a little bit of food, some sunlight. You don't need as much as you think you do, right? And I kind of love that sort of way of looking at life. You know, I think we're all learning that meaning and not having an excess, you know, 3 cars and all this other stuff is
not, for example, having a girl napping on the yacht.
Yeah, not having a girl on the, for God's sake, John, on your sailboat. Although I'm a huge fan of the image. So
that was very unbalanced, I have to admit. and it's true. And I was very unbalanced and actually very unhappy, despite the fact that it sounds idyllic. Mm-hmm. What I realized sitting up there on top of that hill was it wasn't idyllic at all. It was very unbalanced. I was very unhappy. And, yeah, I mean, it sounds good, but it's like so many things, you know.
Yeah.
Well, buy the sailboat, you too will be happy.
That's right.
Well,
that's right.
It's like they always say about sailboats, right? The happiest day of your life is the day you buy the sailboat and the day you sell the sailboat.
yes.
Well, nothing wrong with having things, but I appreciate your service. I think you're a man who has put himself in a position of service. It's why you're probably so tireless. I hear that you spend a great deal of time not only traveling but speaking to people and trying to make the world a better place with your experience and your ideas. And it seems to me you put your money where your mouth is. I mean, Yeah, I'm just looking at the books you've read, and you're such a dreamer. I mean, it's rare to have it's very rare to have an economist, a guy who deals in hard numbers, write a book called Shapeshifting that the Dalai Lama reads, or Spirituar, or any of these books, The World as You Dream It, for example. I know, I'm sure you catch flack from your critics who are like, this guy's a dreamer, he's probably smoking weed, he's coming up with these things, and... But, you know, at the end of the day, I talking to you has been a real privilege because I love your view of the world, and it makes me optimistic.
Thank you. And I just want to say I deeply appreciate what you guys are doing with this show, and that's you're protecting freedom of the press, and you're getting the message out there. And I'd also like to encourage your listeners to go to my website, johnperkins.org, and sign up for my newsletter, which only comes out once a month. And there's a blog that comes out a little more frequently, but that's just on the website. You don't get it sent to you. You only get one sending a month. So please sign up.
JohnPerkins.org. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Great.
Thank you.
And we look forward to reading your next book, Godspeed.
Thank you. And I'd also like to mention DreamChange.org, an incredible organization that I founded that's doing great work, and have people go and take a look at that, too.
And, John, before I let you go, I'm always looking for a charity. I might do this thing with this clothing company where 20% goes to a charity. Look, can you give me the three charities that you like the most where the money goes directly to the people? If people want to give to – I'm always so wary of charities. I don't know. The United Way, you know, somebody told me 99 cents is goes to running the actual company. One cent goes to the charity.
Can you
give us some
I can, and I have to, you know, full disclosure, I'm a little biased. Dream Change, I'm the founder of and chairman of the board, but I think it's a great organization. The Pachamama Alliance, I'm also a co-founder.
How do you spell Pachamama?
P-A-C-H-A-M-A-M-A
okay
.org and Clear Path International, CPI.org, which works with war victims in Southeast Asia and the Middle East, helping war victims improve their lives.
Wow.
And I'll put all of those on the write-up on the website so that if you guys, you know, didn't write that down quickly enough, they will be there.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know, I appreciate you. Anybody who founds charities like that is a friend of mine. I appreciate that. You make the world a better place, John Perkins. So thank you very much. Well, we try. That's the point, you know.
Keep up your great work.
We will. Stay in touch. We'll have you back if you have the time, and I appreciate you making the time. It's so great.
I'd love to. Thanks.
All right. John.
Bye.
That was great. John Perkins, ladies and gentlemen. John Perkins. I know that they're controversial things about, you know, the CIA and how organized corporations are, but I think at the end of the day, if there was such a grand scheme and grand plan between the American government and corporations, it didn't work out so well.
Well, I think the problem is that, you know, I mean, a lot of the United States government, once it arose to world power after World War II, essentially tried to engage in balance of power politics, which had always been the British strategy, mm-hmm. right?
And yeah, we also have to take into account the Soviet Union. I mean,
yeah.
The U.S. was fighting a Cold War.
That's right.
So there were choices that had to be made. You had to support a certain regime or another regime that was going to be worse or as bad. So it's all hindsight, you know.
Well, and I think that's the other thing, too. I mean, you know, I mean, all due respect to John, you know, but he's a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that, you know, talking to my dad last night, he was just saying, you know, it's the classic Einstein quote. Things should be as simple as possible, but no simpler.
Right.
And I think the danger with all of these things, when you start to use terms like corporatocracy, is that you're engaging in an oversimplification where you're making it as if, you know, the bad guys are the corporations, as opposed to the fact that what you have is you have a series of perverse incentive schemes. You know, you have people moving from being long-term greedy to being short-term greedy.
Right.
And, you know.
And I think what I liked about talking to John, though, is I think he you know, his point about people with their pocketbooks make a difference.
Absolutely. That's
and
great.
And I just love that the guy is out there talking to people and founding mm-hmm. organizations. And I mean, I just appreciate a dude that age who's not lost his outrage. A guy who's literally, you could consider I would imagine the book Confessions of an Economic, it might be a little sensationalist. We know it's a little simplified, but at the same time, it does get people kind of their attention.
Yeah.
And I like that in Hoodwinked, in the second part of the book, he says this is the solution. And I think he's right. I think for the most part, you know, he's right about, first of all, he is a capitalist. He is pro-corporations. He's just saying you got to behave responsibly.
Well, I think the interesting thing is, and, you know, it makes a lot of sense that he and Larry Lessig are buddies, because even though the sort of the one paragraph summary makes it sound like there's a conspiracy, he's actually very clear that it's not really a conspiracy in the sense of, you know, Bilderberg, where everybody meets in a room and is like,
yeah,
which country
yeah.
are we going to screw over this week?
Nobody's that organized.
Yeah, exactly. It's more essentially that, you know, people acting in their own short-term interests and then finding places where that overlaps, they end up creating this disastrous system, but it's not some cabal.
Well, look, Citibank, my father lent these countries huge amounts of money. They almost got destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
These banks that were lending these countries money, they were doing it because they couldn't do it in the United States because corporations were able to raise their own money. They didn't mm-hmm. need banks anymore. So mm-hmm. the banks went down, what's called down market.
Mm-hmm.
They went to countries like Mexico, who defaulted on their loan, I think in 82, and basically said, sorry, we're not going to pay you back.
Right.
And Citibank's stock crashed as mm-hmm. a result of that. So, and careers were broken and lost. And, you know, I actually remember my father coming home pulling his hair out. So, you know.
And he's never gotten it back.
And he's never gotten it back. So anyway, the thing to take away is that you can make a difference. And I think John Perkins does a great job in the book Hoodwinked. It's a fun book to read. And everything should always be taken with the understanding that nothing is that simple.
Well,
you said it's not. I thought your point about, you know, I'm either a libertarian or I'm this guy. No, mm-hmm. no. There's a mesh.
And I think that's the interesting thing is that, you know, you would think, for example, that Hoodwinked versus, say, Matt Ridley's book, The Rational Optimist, mm-hmm. would be exact opposites. But when you really listen to what they're saying, they're both saying it's capitalism and regulation.
That's right. And it's getting better.
Yeah.
And they were both optimists. So.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I like John Perkins. I like that guy.
Yeah.
I like him. I look forward to meeting him someday. And it's fun to be able to talk to guys like this. We got to wrap this up. I don't know when I'm going to be doing what, but I'll be doing stand-up sometime. So go to briancallen.com. If you order the book, Hoodwinked, which you should, do it through our link on amazon.com.
And we'll make dozens of pennies.
I'm about to buy a house, everybody, and I can't afford it. I actually can't afford it. It's so funny. So I'm looking forward to living beyond my means, and I'm going to be really stressed out for the rest of the history of this podcast. So don't look for me. Don't look for me as a good financial example. Okay, that's enough. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.